Straight out of Finland, this is the Reluctant Theologian Podcast. I am your host, Dr. R.T. Mullins from the University of Helsinki. In today's episode, Dr. Emma Sani and I continue the chat about my brand new book, God in Emotion, through Cambridge University Press. In this episode, we discuss chapters 3 and 4 of the book, which covers classical theism and neoclassical theism. We get into all sorts of material that didn't make it into the book, so you'll definitely want to hear this. Emma and I discuss the general idea of models of God and their relation to philosophy and theology. We also talk about the role of empathy in the debate over impassibility versus passibility. If you have questions or topics that you would like to hear on the show, you can send me a message at rtmullins.com. Well, ready or not, here's Emma and I talking about God in Emotion. Enjoy. Okay, so on the last episode, we talked through the intro and chapter one of my new book, God in Emotion, which was the first chapter is just on philosophy of emotions, just what is an emotion. So what we want to do in today's episode is talk through the next two chapters, which is the chapter on classical theism and then the chapter on neoclassical theism.
Okay, so this sounds like to me two models of God.
Right.
That's what I heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In my ignorance, I know I hear words thrown around a lot and they stick in my head. Mm-hmm. But so just for clarity, what is a model of God again?
Right. So a model of God is a set of unique claims just about God and some about how God relates to the world.
Okay.
So it's not a full-fledged philosophical story about the world. Right. It is not a full religious story or like a systematic theology.
Okay.
And this is why you can find like the same model of God represented in different religions. Mm. Or by even within the same religion, you can find particular thinkers who will affirm the same model of God, but they'll have like very different philosophical systems. So St. Augustine, for instance, he's a classical theist. Thomas Aquinas, he's also a classical theist. But St. Augustine, he's committed to a bunch of things within like kind of like a broadly Neoplatonic sort of metaphysical story, whereas like Aquinas, he's affirming like an Aristotelian sort of metaphysics. So they have the same model of God, but different ways to kind of develop their metaphysical stories of the world. Mm. But yet then they're also doing Christian theology, so their systematic theology is not identical, but it's similar.
Okay.
So these things, so a model of God, I guess you could say it's like part of your worldview.
Right.
But it's not the full picture.
And how does it work that you have such two different view from the same starting point?
Mm-hmm.
How?
So any worldview is going to want to explain like a certain set of things, like why is there anything at all? Mm-hmm. Why are things the way that they are, and kind of like what is the ultimate nature of reality and how do these things fit together? And okay. If you've got God in your story, that can answer a bunch of these questions, but depending on what you think the nature of God is like, there might be other ways you can answer a whole bunch of other different kinds of questions.
Right.
So it fits really well with like a lot of different metaphysical stories about how they want to say where the world comes from. So let me give you, I guess, two examples of this. So like Christians, Jews, and Muslims, for the most part, affirm a doctrine of creation out of nothing, where the universe has this absolute beginning. It didn't always exist, but it has this absolute beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got God explaining where the universe comes from. Whereas some other like thinkers, like say like within Hinduism, and then some different pagan thinkers in like different Neoplatonic traditions.
Yeah.
And then Aristotle, they don't think the universe began to exist.
Okay.
But they think God's responsible for the existence of the universe.
Okay.
Because it's like maybe God's like always creating it.
Constantly?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So he never began to create it. He's always been creating it.
Right.
From eternity past. This is just what he's been doing.
Okay.
So you've got God explaining the existence of the entire contingent world.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, but you can see some differences here. Like, did the universe always exist? Some would say yes. Some would say no.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And so I know in your book, you focus on two models of God, but just out of curiosity, how many models do you have like in the number of 10, 100, thousands, millions, just to have an idea.
I would say there's like five like real working models. So I want to say
that's okay. It's quite limited.
It's limiting.
I thought people were going more wild on it.
Well, there are a lot of people who do want to go a lot more wild, but some of them I don't think are plausible. Some of them I don't think make any sense. So here's an example. So I want to say there's classical theism, neoclassical theism, open theism, panentheism, and pantheism.
Yeah.
There are some other people, though, they're like, maybe there's this thing called emergent theism, where you've got the universe exists, and then God somehow, like, later on emerges out of the universe.
Okay.
And I just want to go, that's not really a model of God. Because I think a model of God is, like, so Benedict Gurka, he's going to say, what a model of God has to do is it has to explain how, like, this one thing, God, is, like, the ultimate source or ground or cause of all of contingent reality.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas on this emergent theist story, you've got this universe exists. Where did it come from? What explains it? I don't know. It's not there. But somehow, at some point, millions and millions of years later, God emerges out of it. And so you don't have God as, like, the single ground of everything.
It sounds pretty odd.
It sounds super weird. Yeah.
But nobody created God, I guess, in this model.
Oh, no, you wouldn't say emerged. Created, because he emerged, and we use the vague.
I love when they start playing on words.
Right, yeah, emergence theory, you know.
Yeah we love it's this. Not creation.
It's no,
just it's emerged. Been vomited out from whatever.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, the universe just kind of vomited up God.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I don't consider that as a live option, so I'm like, no. So
you
I stick
know what?
With
five. It sounds fair.
Yeah.
But, okay, so you decide two model of gods.
Right.
You go for it.
Yeah.
Why did you pick those two?
Right. So I knew classical theism was the main one I wanted to look at, mm-hmm. because that's where you really see impassibility affirmed. And then originally I was thinking, I'll look at passibility. But I was like, passibility is found in a bunch of different models of God. You can find neoclassical theists affirming it. You can find open theists and panentheists affirming it. Not all panentheists do, but some do. Then I could also find it in lots of different, like, wildly different theological systems.
Okay.
And so I was like, well, gosh, this is going to be too much because the book has to be super short.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, either
you have to give up on something.
Exactly. So I decided, fine, I'll just go with neoclassical theism and call it a day.
That's mean that you're going to focus on other ones later on? Or
exactly. Uh-huh. So spinning out some papers on panentheism and open theism. And then at some point down the road, write a nice book where I'm like, here are these different models. Let's see how we test them against each other.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice. Mm-hmm. Nice plan for the future.
Right.
So what is classical theism?
Right. So classical theism. So classical theism affirms four unique attributes of God. So they're going to say things like God's omnipotent, omniscient, all that jazz. But everybody says that. That's not interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, but it's not, you know, it doesn't really help me tell.
We all agree on that. So
yeah,
exactly. What's the point to
exactly.
focus on that?
Yeah. So where classical theism makes unique claims are these four attributes of timelessness, immutability, simplicity, and impassibility. And the impassibility one is obviously important for the book.
Of course, because it's an emotion book.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So timelessness. Timelessness is the claim that God exists necessarily exist without beginning, without end, without succession, without temporal location, and without temporal extension. So no location whatsoever in time.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then immutability connects with this quite nicely, because so part of the claim of timelessness was no succession, which means like no change. And immutability just literally means unchanging.
So wait, if I'm following this.
Mm-hmm.
God has no change.
Correct.
Or the universe has no change. The universe obviously have change. I've seen changing every moment.
Right, yeah, you're feeling it change all the time.
Exactly. Yeah. So I feel like God is not going to keep up with anything then.
Well, that's a big worry. And that's what I talk about in my first book, The End of a Timeless God. I'm like, how can you have God, a changeless God coexisting with a changeless universe or a changing universe?
Hmm.
How can you have a God who exists without succession, being omnipresent, to an ever-changing world filled with succession? It's a hard sell. But most people throughout history have affirmed it. And so I'm like, okay, we'll give it a shot. Okay. And then I gave it a shot and I was like, yeah, I don't think this works. But
yeah. Well, I think that would be possible if not. I mean, the only way it can be possible that God knows all the future, all of it, well in advance, so he knows every possible change already.
Right.
So it doesn't matter if he doesn't change.
Well, there's a lot of what's called the sourcehood question, which very rarely gets talked about in contemporary debates, but it was huge in the Middle Ages, which is, how does God know the future? And because they're committed to a theory called presentism, which says the present is the only moment that exists.
Right.
So the future is not there to be, like, literally seen by God or anything like that. And in fact, they don't even want to say that God could, his knowledge could be dependent upon time whatsoever. How absurd to think that is what like different thinkers say. How dare we say that God's knowledge be based on time? I mean, that's according to Boethius. So what you get is somehow like God causes everything that happens. And that's how he knows everything. He knows everything that's going to happen because he knows the cause. And he's the cause himself. So that's how he knows it on the classical story.
Yes, but still doesn't explain.
How's he changing?
Yes.
Nope, it doesn't. It does not. Really, and that's a serious problem.
Yeah.
And to emphasize how unchanging it is, sometimes people want to, contemporary thinkers will want to say, well, maybe God can undergo what's called these mere Cambridge changes, where it just changes like in relationship to stuff. And that's not the traditional view, because the traditional view says God's not really related to the universe, precisely so they can avoid saying God undergoes just merely relational change. And then a contemporary thinker like Paul Helm, who is one of the biggest living defenders of divine timelessness, in his book, The Eternal God, he says, what kind of changelessness, what kind of immutability do we need for timelessness? He's like, one where God cannot undergo mere Cambridge change, mere extrinsic change, or mere relational change. He makes this very explicit.
Okay.
So it's, there's no, any kind of change you can think of, you got to go, no, no.
That's because he's unrelated to the universe.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, but this being unrelated to the universe, it would put you in a very different situation if you, you know, want to kind of relate with the creature in the universe.
Yeah.
Especially if you talk about emotion, if we're so unrelated. How are you going to deal with that?
Right. So let's talk about simplicity and then we get into that. So simplicity says all of God's attributes are identical to each other. And then identical to his essence and existence.
Okay. Make me an example. What do you mean?
So you've got wisdom and you've got power.
Thank you. I do.
But, you know, sometimes you're not quite as powerful on some days. Maybe you get a cold or something. But you're still really wise. Other days, you know, maybe you're just not thinking very well. But you're super powerful. And so, like, these things, like, they're not identical. They're, like, they're different attributes that you have. Well, in God, they're identical.
Because they always have the same strength?
No, they're just there. They're always there. So
okay. But so, no. Yeah. I don't understand, because if you say are identical, it means they are the same thing.
They're the exact same thing.
But you just describe two different things.
I know.
So I'm confused.
Well, this is what everybody's confused about. This is why there was, I think Graham Oppie, I think he wrote a paper called The Devilish Complexity of Divine Simplicity. Because it's just such a difficult doctrine to really nail down, because you've got these crazy identity claims of whatever you want to properly attribute to God, be it power, wisdom, beauty, you know, and so on. This is Augustine's list. And he's like, we mean the same thing. We're identifying the same thing. It's just God. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's really strong. And God's actions, those are identical to each other, such that he has one timeless act, one unchanging act. And that one act is identical to his essence and his existence.
I don't know. I don't even know what to say on this.
Most people, that's the reaction. Other than people who've been corrupted by theology, usually obviously. When I usually when I tell them about this, they'll say that's gobbledygook. And
okay.
Yeah. So you know, but whatever. We've done episodes on that. We'll do more episodes on that in the future.
Okay, so...
But impassibility, though, that question you had earlier.
Yeah, so we have timelessness, immutability, simplicity, and impassibility.
Yes.
Those are the...
So impassibility, yeah. So let's talk about that, because you'd asked, if this God's unchanging, like, how's he going to...
Exactly. Relate? How can relate to creatures?
Right. Well, he's not really related.
Yeah, because it's outside the universe.
Exactly.
Where it's not...
located. Well, he's not where.
He's not where.
He's not where or when.
Oh, sorry. But he's aware of people.
He's supposed to be, because part of what it means to be omnipresent is this is what's bizarre. So we said God's not really related to the universe. on classical theism.
Yes.
But classical theism also says God's omnipresent. Which
so it's everywhere.
He's everywhere. By knowledge and by power.
So he should know what we are doing right now.
He should. Because the reason anything is happening right now is because God knows it and he's causing it to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, his knowledge and his power are identical. So him knowing it is him causing it. Him causing it just is him knowing it.
I'm feeling that if I'm causing something, I'm a kind of related
to, seems like you're really related
to that, mm-hmm. you know, just mm-hmm. because I'm doing an action.
I mean, I'm not going to say that it was an ad hoc move by St. Augustine to avoid problems to be like, oh, by the way, he's not really related. But I've said it before, and I'll definitely say it in the future. I'm just not saying it right now. So
not saying it. Not saying it.
You know, as my sister would say, I'm not saying, I'm just saying. Mm-hmm. So here's what you get with impassibility, though. So impassibility says three things. First, God cannot suffer. Second, it is metaphysically or logically impossible for God to be moved or influenced or like caused by anything outside of himself.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. So I feel very sorry for people that pray.
Well, yeah, because your prayers cannot influence God.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. But also your sins can't influence God. So that's maybe a bonus.
That's a plus, I guess.
Might be a plus.
You know?
We'll talk about that later. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you can't influence God in any way, shape, or form.
And so not a good way and a bad way.
Correct, because it's just, you can't influence him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the third claim is that God cannot have any emotion, well, he can't have any passions, because impassibility means no passions. But this is where it gets tricky, though, because what we call emotions isn't the same thing as what people in the past would have called passions.
Okay. Because, so we have a different definition.
Well, it's our English word for emotion covers a whole bunch of different stuff, some mm-hmm. of which are passions, some of which are not.
Okay.
And then when you look at the history of ideas, what counts as a passion, everybody disagrees on that.
Okay.
And that's like super annoying. So what I was able to do is I was able to identify three different criteria that people use throughout history to decide which what we'll call emotions, which emotions God can have and which God cannot have. And by which, I mean literally which emotions God can have and not have, because lots of classical theists would say God metaphorically has a bunch of different stuff. Like they'll say, like Aquinas, for instance, says God literally cannot be merciful and literally cannot be compassionate. But maybe like metaphorically, sure. Maybe figuratively of some sort.
And that's supposed to make me feel better?
Maybe. I don't know.
But look, if it's impossible, mm-hmm. it shouldn't have any emotion whatsoever.
You might think that. But like we talked about in the last episode, they want to say he's perfectly happy. And so that's one of the criteria. So God can have any emotion that's consistent with his perfect happiness.
I don't understand why they picked that one. So that's fine. Any other emotion is not good.
Well, so here are the three criteria. Any emotion that's consistent with being perfectly rational, because you don't want to have God having irrational emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And then any emotion that's consistent with perfect moral goodness,
mm-hmm.
because you don't want God, being filled with like lust or something. Like that seems a bit, a bit creepy. And then anything that's consistent with perfect happiness. And as we talked about in the last episode, this is because most ethical theories, the idea is everybody wants to be happy. Mm-hmm. How do you get it? By being acquainted with whatever the greatest good is. And since on most theistic understandings, God is the greatest good.
Mm-hmm.
God's perfectly acquainted with himself. He's, because he's identical to the greatest good.
Right.
So, and he's identical. So he's going to be identical to his happiness. So you're going to get the happiness for free just by being the greatest good. Is kind of the idea.
Yeah, no, I know we talked about this before, but for me, if you like you say that is someone is impossible, they mm-hmm. should have zero emotion. I'm mm-hmm. sorry. I don't understand why you granted one.
Right.
It just feels odd. You just pick the one that you like, but whatever.
Right. That's actually a big complaint throughout most of the 20th century. A lot of theologians want to go, this is an apathetic God, and meaning like, he just can't have any emotions whatsoever. He's an emotionless monster. And then much classical theists, as they're kind of like, regaining interest in impassibility. They're like, no. Like, he really could have some emotions. He's got all the positive emotions. And I'm like, that is the traditional claim. So I'll go ahead and grant him that, because I want to accurately portray what the view is. I can point out inconsistencies later, but I at least want to get, here's the view on the table.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we have a God unrelated to you, to the universe,
yep.
but he's completely happy about this.
He's completely happy.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you basically have no empathy.
Correct.
Or compassion.
Correct.
For anyone or not, anything.
Yeah. Correct. Because you can't literally have these things. You can metaphorically have it. So here's what Anselm says to try to get out of some of these things. And this is pretty standard for most early church fathers and medieval thinkers. So to literally have like mercy or compassion is first, like, I see you and I feel bad for you.
Mm-hmm.
And then because of that, then I try to do something to help you get out of your terrible situation.
Okay.
And so that's what it means to like literally like have mercy towards you.
Okay.
And then you could do something similar with compassion. Because it means some kind of feeling with you. And because of that feeling with you, then I'm motivated to do something on your behalf. So Anselm's like, well, God could metaphorically have mercy by doing something to help you get out of your terrible situation.
I thought he was completely unrelated to me.
Well, yeah, he's not motivated by your situation to get you out of it. And he's not feeling bad for you or anything like that, because we can't have God being influenced.
Mm-hmm.
But he still does whatever it is to help you get out of your situation, so we can say he's metaphorically merciful. So he still does actions that a merciful person would do, but he doesn't actually have mercy because he doesn't have the feeling or anything that goes
with it. So basically, he knows that's the right thing to do, but I'm not connected to emotionally to feel that that's the right thing to do.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay.
That's the most generous way to put it.
Yeah. It sounds very limiting. It seems like you're missing something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's a big complaint throughout the 20th century of going, like, it seems like God's actions are kind of arbitrary because you're missing the whole point of, like, why would you do anything at all? Why would I help you if you're in a bad situation? Well, it seems like I'm aware that you're in a bad situation, and I'm mm-hmm. motivated by that fact to get you out of the situation. But this is a God who can't be influenced by anything.
Mm-hmm.
So it can't be motivated by your situation to help you get out of it. And so you're like, well, what's going on here? So yeah. There's some missing pieces to the story, or at least it seems like there's some inconsistencies in the story. And we'll get at those in later on. But yeah, that's kind of a big worry that people bring up.
Okay. So mm-hmm. this was all under the classical theism umbrella.
Correct.
Okay. What is neoclassical theism?
Mm-hmm. So neoclassical theism is a model of God where you're trying to make just like some modifications to the classical view. So you still want to affirm like God has exhaustive foreknowledge. So it's not like open theism. And you don't think that like, you know, God is somehow like identical to the universe, or that like God and the universe like necessarily coexist. So it's not panentheism or pantheism. So it really is just like this kind of like slight, trying to make some modifications to the classical view.
Okay.
But as we talked about in like a previous episode, like it's really messy how you go about doing that, because you could just deny any one of those four classical attributes and still be a neoclassical theist.
Nice.
And so as we talked about in one of the other episodes.
High definition.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yes.
So what I did the book was I was like, well, that's just garbage. So let's just have a nice, neat view. So I'm like, let's have a view where we reject all four of these attributes, these classical attributes. But we've got these. What we have in place is God is, instead of being timeless, God is temporal.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of being immutable, he's mutable. So he can change
right.
in certain respects. Instead of being simple, he's just unified. And instead of being impassible, he is passible. And so what it does, at least in the book, is I've got this nice parallel now between each, like, four sets of competing attributes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I've still got, in both stories, God knows the future. So I had to bracket out open theism and other views.
Okay, like that. But to me, it seems like these two models are completely opposite of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd say it's a slight modification, but
right.
it sounds huge difference.
It is. It's voice. Much bigger than what most people in the literature let on.
Because
right. they're like, we're making some slight stuff. And I'm like, in my view, a lot of theologians, they're like, well, I could still say God's timeless, even though like he's in time. And I'm like, timelessness is not the sort of thing that you can just kind of add a little bit of time to and it's okay. Same thing with immutability. You can't be like, God doesn't change except every once in a while. And then simplicity, you can't be like, you know, God like doesn't have any parts or properties or tropes or universe, like doesn't have any of this stuff, but then sometimes he does. And I'm like, no, you can't say these things. That's incoherent. That's nonsense. So let's not muddy the waters here. Let's put the real things in place that we're doing. We really are switching these out for something different.
Right.
And so what I do in the book is try to be much more intellectually honest than I think most people are.
Mm-hmm.
So temporality, any view that says God undergoes succession like he does one thing and then another, has a series of moments in his life.
Right.
Then you're going to say God's temporal.
Okay.
So God exists without beginning and without end, never begins to exist, never ceases to exist.
Mm-hmm.
And you get that from God's necessary existence, which all models of God, for the most part, want to affirm that God necessarily exists. He has to exist.
Okay.
And so you get without him existing without beginning, without end, you get that for free from necessary existence.
Okay.
But God undergoing change and succession, I think this just follows from the fact that God has power. He's like all powerful and he has free will. Because God can do what he wants. He can do one thing or another.
Mm-hmm.
And when he performs an action, he goes from not doing that action to doing that action. So I think that the idea of change and succession in God's life just follows very straightforwardly from God's power and God's freedom.
Yeah, that to make makes sense. I actually struggle to see the opposite, like to be timelessness.
Yeah, and so what I think is when you start drawing some of these connections the way that I do in the book, is you start seeing this view seems like it's a lot easier to understand from the start, which is usually a pretty good thing for any theory. And then also, I don't have to justify a lot of these really stronger claims like timelessness or simplicity or anything like that. So it's a much easier model of God to grasp, which is a theoretical virtue. It's a much simpler story. So that's a theoretical virtue. And there's less stuff to try to justify. There's less baggage attached to it. So I think there's a lot of good virtues of the theory.
Okay. So the next one is the mutability.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think people don't want God to change?
Right.
What is the problem there?
Yeah. So what I do in this is my first book, Into the Timeless God, I identify some different underlying assumptions that are in play in a lot of people's intuitions in the past. So one's called the Platonic assumption, which is that all change is for the better or worse.
Right.
Yeah, there's no value neutral changes.
That's ridiculous.
It's not an assumption that most people affirm today, but it is. Okay. It was a widely affirmed in the past, and I think you could easily reject it. But that's the underlying assumption. So if God changes, well, then he's getting better or he's getting worse. And if he's perfect, he shouldn't be getting better.
Yeah.
And if he's perfect, then what could it mean to get worse?
He's not going to get worse.
Exactly.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So that's the worry that they have. And then sometimes you'll get these extra worries that people will have that I think are really silly, where they're like, well, if God could change, then like he could cease to exist. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He's a necessarily existent being. Or if God could change, then like maybe he's going to stop loving you or he's going to like stop being good. And I'm like, well, no, that's part of his essence.
Yeah.
In essential properties or in essence, by definition, those are things you cannot lose and continue to exist. So if you're a necessarily existent being, that's part of your essence, and then you're essentially good, essentially powerful, essentially, you know, whatever, then you just can't lose those things.
Yeah. I was wondering, like, if you have a God that somehow relate to his creature, don't you think he's acquiring a kind of knowledge by interacting with them? Like, obviously, people behave in a certain way, and we have free will.
Mm-hmm.
So somehow we can actually teach something to God. How do we behave, and he can learn even more, or he has like maximum knowledge. So that's the threshold.
No, this is good. This is something I do touch on in the book. So this is related to passibility and how God's knowledge. So let me quickly say what passibility is.
Mm-hmm.
So passibility is just this claim that God can be influenced by the world, and so he can suffer, and so he can have a range of emotions.
Yes.
And those emotions are going to be consistent with perfect rationality and perfect goodness. But the big thing at the moment, though, what you're pointing out is, well, he can be influenced. So it seems like we could teach God something.
It's not just even be influenced. It can, like, as a scientist, I'm just looking at some lizard in a box, for example.
Right.
And I'm just like, oh, I'm giving this food. The lizard don't like this food. Why? I have no idea. So give this other food.
Sure.
Oh, no, they like it. Do I have any emotional attachment to this lizard? No, whatsoever.
Yeah,
but I learned something new from there.
Right. So you're able to...
So I was just going from something very basic.
Right.
Like, not even emotional attachment. Like, can we actually give... Do we have something to give?
Yeah. So I think the universe does. So like I said, on this view, the claim is that God has exhaustive knowledge of the future. So he has what's called... tenseless knowledge. So God could arrange like a timeline. And so tenseless knowledge is like knowledge of like things that are like at specific dates. So Ryan and Emma talk at, you know, August whatever, 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a really specific date. It doesn't have a reference to past, present, or future.
Right.
Now, if you have that kind of knowledge, that doesn't really tell you what's happening now. Mm-hmm. Because if I know, you know, that Emma and Ryan talk on like the 14th of August, well, are they talking now? Has the 14th of August already happened? Is that something forthcoming? Is it in the past? Ooh, I don't know. Mm-hmm. Tense list knowledge doesn't give you that. What you need is what's called tensed knowledge, which right. is knowledge of what was the case, what will be the case, and what is happening right now. Mm-hmm. And God cannot, so on this sort of story, God's not going to change in terms of his tense list knowledge, but he will change in terms of his tensed knowledge, because as history is unfolding, as time is moving forward, what's going to be changing is what was the case, what will be the case, what's happening right now. Those things are going to be constantly changing. Mm-hmm. So God's like, you know, I'm going to create a universe where things go this particular way. Well, now I'm creating a universe. And that means I used to exist without a universe. And so his knowledge is going to change in that regard.
Okay, yes.
Yeah. And so he's going to be aware of what's happening in the universe, and that's going to be changing his tensed knowledge, but not his tenseless knowledge.
I see.
And so this is all in terms of just his propositional knowledge. So he could have maximal knowledge. He knows all the things that there are to know. Mm-hmm. But all the things that there are to know are going to be undergoing changes. And God's knowledge is always going to be tracking those changes perfectly.
Okay.
On this view, yeah.
Okay, wow. I feel we didn't talk about the unity.
Oh, yeah, we skipped over unity.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right, so we had simplicity, which said, you know, all of God's attributes, actions, etc., they're identical to God. On Bizarre. Unity, yeah, we don't have to do that with this sort of divine unity view. You just say God's attributes, they're, you know, things that God has necessarily, mm-hmm. at least his essential attributes. And his essential attributes are, like, necessarily coextensive. So you're not going to find, you know, God existing in some possible world where he doesn't have his power. You're not going to find his power and his goodness just like floating free from him. Like all of a sudden he just loses them. Like that's, you know, no, he's just like, his essence is perfectly unified.
So I'm actually sold on these neoclassical theism, but okay. I'm sure there yeah. are problems.
Yeah. We'll get to those in another mm-hmm. episode. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just give me a quick bite of those problems and then right. we leave it for the next episode mm-hmm. but you know, because it sounds so good right now, so.
Right, the problem
is not
the problems typically relate to empathy, which is something we haven't talked about enough yet.
Yes.
So we should probably actually get into that.
Yeah
so the passible God, like I said, he can have like a range of emotions and he can be influenced, mm-hmm. but and he can have this kind of what's called this experiential knowledge, which right. is like knowledge of what it's like. So there's something that it's like to create a universe, something that it's like to answer prayers. And this is different than his propositional knowledge that we talked about a minute ago. Mm-hmm. But the extent of that experiential knowledge, that's something that people who are affirming passibility haven't really defined what all is going to fit into there. But what has just been discussed the most, though, is empathy. And so right. I focus on that for the book, because that's a big dividing line between impassibility and passibility. So empathy.
What is that?
Empathy is three things. And so Ryan empathizes with Emma. If I know that you have a particular emotion, say like happiness. Mm-hmm. Second thing is I know what it's like to feel happy.
Okay.
And then third, something about you like grounds my ability to be aware of the fact that you are happy. Mm. Because it has to be really related to you. Something about you moves me to empathize with you and to be like, this is what it's like for Emma to feel happy.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's just specific to me and not someone else.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because otherwise, because if the whole point when I'm empathizing with someone, I'm trying to empathize with that person.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, yeah.
Yes.
So if I am like,
very specific.
Exactly. Yeah. So if I'm like, okay, Emma's feeling sad right now. And you'd be like, no, I'm not. And I'm like, oh, sorry, it was that other person over there I empathized with. And be like, well, then you just really suck at empathizing with me.
You know? You really do.
Yeah. And so that would be really terrible. Also, when I'm empathizing with you, I'm trying to figure out what it's like for you to feel a particular way that you
okay.
do. So say, like, you get some really good news and you're very happy about it. Like, say you get a new job and you're like, mm-hmm. I got this new job. I'm really excited. And I'm like, oh, man, I'm really excited, too, that I got this new job.
Yay.
And you're like, no, I got the new job. You didn't. And that would be like, oh, right. So I've failed to empathize with you because I've like hijacked your emotions in this very bizarre sort of way. And I failed to like rationally distinguish myself from you. That's bad. So when I empathize with you, I'm trying to figure out what it's like for you to feel that way. And then once I do that, if I'm successful with this, which most of us are not.
Some people are.
I was reading up, this is a weird side note, when I was reading up on some different psychological literature on who's better at empathy, there's some different stuff on like different genders, like how do people with different genders, like can you predict if they're going to be better at empathizing? Mm-hmm. Women report that they are better at empathizing than men do.
Right.
But the different studies, what the studies showed was that based just purely on gender, you can't make any good predictions.
Okay.
Yeah. Like it seems like men and women are empathizing at pretty much equal abilities. But one particular gender is more likely to say that they're better at it than another.
Yeah, it's kind of this thing, like we always say this type of stuff, right?
Yeah, but one of the other things that comes out of the psychological literature is that it's really hard to empathize with lots of people.
Well, I think if you're not related to someone, it's going to be really hard.
Yes.
Obviously, if not, it's just like a defense mechanism. Mm-hmm. If not, every time I'm watching the news, oh my God, I would just cry all day long. Because, you know, you have all this sad news from all over the world. And you cannot get over your life.
Exactly. Yeah. So the ability to like empathize with someone, it's difficult. The ability to do it accurately, it's difficult. The ability to empathize with a certain number of people, that's challenging. Mm-hmm. But that's the case with humans. So when it comes to God, lots of people in the passibility camp, they want to say that God can have like perfect empathy.
Yes.
And so it's not going to be hard for him. It's not going to be overwhelming for him. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be inaccurate. It's going to be perfectly accurate. And this is what Linda Zygrzebski calls omnisubjectivity.
Right.
Which is like this capacity for like perfect, total empathy with like all creaturely conscious states. Mm-hmm. And so this is the most like robust version of passibility you can find. Because passibility is just this, you know, like God can have a range of emotions. He can be influenced, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But how much empathy is he going to have? Like, this is like this is the maximal amount. Like, I mean, this is omni subjectivity. It's like all the empathy you could possibly get.
Yes. I mean, I think it's a good thing to have if you can snap out of that.
Yes.
Because, you know, if I can feel very related to someone and very empathic to someone. Mm-hmm. But then I have to go back to my life.
Right.
If not, I would be on a perennial state of like sadness, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Right. Or happiness.
Or happiness, yes.
It depends. Yeah. Well,
but
this is,
I don't know. It would be more sadness because if you think about all the stuff in the world.
Right. There's a lot of sadness going on.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, and usually you're more moved from like, I think bad emotion stick more to you.
They can, yeah. And so these are what are called recalcitrant emotions. Like they're ones that like you just can't get rid of.
Yeah.
They really stick around. And it does seem to be the ones that really haunt us. Those are the ones that they're haunting because they stick around, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, so just, that was a kind of redundant way to explain recalcitrant emotions. But so Zygrzebski, she doesn't really go into some of that stuff, even though I think that she ought to. As far as I can tell, there's certain affective states that God would not have.
Mm-hmm.
So I should say this. So when she talks about God empathizing, she makes it really clear that God's just figuring out this is what it's like for you to feel this way.
Mm-hmm.
And when you empathize with someone, then you can make your own emotional judgment on that situation. So if I empathize with you about you being really happy about kicking a puppy, for instance, which I know that you wouldn't feel happy about kicking a puppy.
It's terrible.
Maybe that seagull that always like taps on our window at 5 a.m, you know, you might be happy about kicking that thing.
Yes.
If that was the case...
Don't push me on that.
Well, right. If that was the case, then like I would, you know, I'd be like, yeah, I'm happy that you kicked that seagull. But if you kick some random puppy, I would be like, you're gross. Like, I'm like, this is what you're taking delight in this. I can understand like, and I can feel like you're taking delight in this. And I'm like, that's gross. So I can make my own judgment on the thing I'm empathizing with.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing with God, is God can make a judgment on the situation. And Zygrzebski says, like, it's because God has this perfect empathy that he can be the perfect moral judge. Because when he fully understands your situation and fully understands this is what it's like to be you and for you to feel this, then he can really judge accordingly and properly in a really accurate way. I think that's helps a bit. But some of the things you're pointing out, though, is like, well, what about all the sadness? What about, wouldn't that really get God down?
Yeah, but for this claim, we never heard that seagull.
Right, yeah, we never did, because...
Because he just come 5 a.m.,
yeah.
Tap on the window and leave.
And he
as
leaves.
As soon as I get up.
He's just like, hey, wake up. And I'm like,
Yeah.
No, it's five.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's move on.
So let's move on. So we've never once kicked a seagull. Yes, we should make that clear. So how is God going to be sad all the time? So there's certain things that has not been discussed yet, and I only barely touch them on the book, and then some others I don't. So here's some brand new material that I've not written anywhere. I want to say God does not have moods, because like a mood in philosophy of emotion is typically said to be like non-rational. Like you get in a bad mood and it just kind of colors everything that you see. And so it's not directed at anything in particular. You just hate everything and you hate nothing. And same thing, like if you're feeling like lazy or like you just can't get up, like get motivated, everything's terrible, you know, but nothing's terrible. Those are irrational.
Yes.
And they lead to irrational emotions, at least according to most philosophers of emotion. And so I want to say, well, God can't have those. If God's perfectly rational, he's not going to have a mood. So you're never going to get catch God in a bad day. Like, that's not going to be a worry.
Okay.
Because he's perfectly rational. Another thing that I think you get a knock-on effect from God being perfectly rational and God not being able to have any emotions that are inconsistent with his perfect rationality is I don't think you're going to have God having these recalcitrant or these haunting emotions. So the sadness, it's God's only going to feel the sadness for the appropriate amount of time. And it's always going to be proportionate to his understanding of, you know, I've got this plan for the world. The world's going to go this way. It, you know, I understand, like, you're feeling really hopeless right now.
Right.
That's really terrible. But I can't feel utterly hopeless because I know what the plan is. And I know that I'm going to succeed in this plan. And it's going to be okay. It's going to get better.
So you mentioned this plan for the world. So all the models of God, they have the same plan for the world?
Oh, no, no, no.
Not even that?
Well, not even that. Like, it, I don't even think... Okay, God's plan for the world, that's a thicker claim than I think a model of God's going to give you.
Okay, okay.
That's going to get into your specific system.
I see.
So here's a really great example of this. Richard Creel, who's got this book from the 80s defending impassibility, and so he wants to give you this, you know, fully classical understanding of God, and he's like, maybe God's purpose for the world is just, you know, just to create a world where it's possible for people to love him. Does anybody, you know, actually end up loving God back? Does anybody actually get into heaven? Don't care. I really don't care. Because God's goal was just to like create creatures where it's possible for that sort of stuff to happen. Whether or not they succeed doesn't matter, because God's only goal was the super limited one.
Okay.
And you're like,
just to create something.
Just to create some stuff and then give them some possibilities. And I'm like, that's it? Ooh, okay.
Yeah, well... why not? I mean, if I were able to create some weird creature, I would play with that. And probably after a while, you're like, meh, okay.
Right.
In a box somewhere.
It gets them out of like the problem of evil, because you're like, why would God let all this suffering happen? Like, doesn't it, you know, wouldn't it be a failure if everybody like rejects him? And he's like, nah.
He's like, nah, because he
that never, wasn't his goal.
It wasn't his goal. It was just like, try out what I could do. That's it. That's
exactly. So I think when you start talking about like really specifying what is God's goal, then you start getting into the more the realm of like someone's systematic theology.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, and outside their model of God.
Okay, so we're not going in there.
No.
No. Next book.
Yeah, the next book. And there you have it, another episode of the Reluctant Theologian Podcast. Stay tuned for more episodes on God and emotion.